From Swarthmore College, this is War News Radio.
I'm Ann Kolker.
And I'm Ren Elhai.
They are fighting over actual religious identity, and each group wants not to be kind of submerged or overshadowed by the other, you see.
This week, something different. Iraq 101. We reach into our archive to hear some Iraqi history. History that's a prerequisite to understanding the war news we hear every day. We'll find out about sectarianism, Islamic law, and how the British ruled and got out of Iraq.
To begin, almost every one of our newscasts carries a story of violent clashes between Sunni and Shia. For example, recently we brought you an in-depth look at events surrounding the attack on the Golden Mosque in Samarra. The bombing and riots showed religious tensions close to the surface. What are the origins of that rivalry between Sunni and Shia Islam? Here's War News Radio Professor Emeritus of History, Alan Smith.
Like many religious rivalries, this one stems from the question, who is closest to God? The Shia argue that the only people fit to lead the community descend directly from Prophet Muhammad, who lived in the 7th century.
The Shias believe that after the Prophet, only his cousin and son-in-law, Ali, would have been the legitimate successor to the Prophet.
Dr. Muhammad Ayyub, professor of Islamic Studies and Comparative Religion at Temple University. He explains that Ali was passed over repeatedly as religious leader, or caliph, in the growing Muslim empire. But who ruled instead in those early years of Islam? Swarthmore student Ruben Hayman Cantor.
The first three of the four rightly guided caliphs, according to Sunni Islam, are the first three leaders of the Ummah, the Muslim community, after Muhammad. According to the Shia, these three men are considered usurpers, which you can imagine is quite a split in doctrine between the two groups.
And quite a political split as well. One faction believing that three faithful followers of Muhammad had been ruling, the others awaiting the one blood successor, Ali. The question of who carries the religious message becomes a matter of who is fit to lead the community. The Sunni say it is enough to be guided by Muhammad. The Shia say that, to be fit to lead, you must be directly descended. Again, Dr. Ayyub.
The Sunnis say that the Sunnah of the Prophet, that is his life example, and the community are sufficient basis to keep the Muslims on the straight path till the end of time. The Shias say no, since God so willed that always the community should be guided by a person who is protected by God from error.
The Sunni minority has been in control of Iraq, stretching back to when the ancient Ba'athists moved the Muslim capital to Baghdad in the 8th century.
Abbasids took over, who are descendants of the uncle of the Prophet. They took over and moved the capital to Baghdad. Although the Abbasids came to power on the shoulders of a Shiite revolution asking for the rule of the family of Muhammad, very soon they actually ruled as Sunnis and oppressed the Shias. And for like more than 500 years of Abbasid rule, Baghdad was the cultural and spiritual and religious center of the Muslim world. And it continued to be important under Ottoman rule, which was also Sunni.
Shia believe it is their right to lead the community, that it is this divine connection between the leader and Muhammad and therefore God.
Again, Ruben Hayman Cantor.
The Sunni, the Ottoman sultans, never claimed that they were the most religious, the most capable of leading. Their rule was primarily secular.
The Iraqi Sunnis and Shias are not fighting over the ideas that I have explained. They are fighting over actual religious identity, and each group wants not to be kind of submerged or overshadowed by the other, you see?
Dr. Muhammad Ayyub says that today's religious battle is not so much about the doctrine, but about religious survival. The Sunnis fear a backlash from generations in power. The Shia fear being subjugated again. But Ayyub says that there is a third path that has some historical precedent.
In long periods of peace and stability, the Shias did their bit, you know, like celebrating the Ashura days and the death of the third Imam Hussein and crying and beating themselves. All this was tolerated by the rest of the Muslims.
Does religious unity have a chance in the midst of war? Perhaps. When Iraq fought Iran in the 1980s, Iraqi Shias fought Iranian Shias to protect their nation.
The war between Iran and Iraq, when Saddam Hussein is considered to have committed many of his crimes against humanity, those crimes were crimes he committed against Shia in his own country for fear that the majority and long-repressed Shia community of Iraq would join the Shia-Iranian nation. What in fact happened during the war from 1980 to 1988 is that those Shia in Iraq did not join the Iranian forces and fought and died to protect their country, their Arab, if Sunni-dominated nation.
But do those feelings of national pride still exist? That is almost impossible to predict, says Reuben Hayman Cantor, who suggests that foreign troops might be a necessary ingredient for Sunnis and Shias to find common ground.
There is a famous Arab saying, you know, my brother and I against my cousin and I against my neighbor and I against the outsider. And whether or not with the lack of a foreign aggressor, what would happen between the Shia and Sunni communities in Iraq, I think it's hard to know.
For War News Radio, I'm Alan Smith.
This is War News Radio, our special on the history of Iraq. The Sunni-Shia split has important political as well as religious implications. In writing the new Iraqi constitution, lawmakers were careful to give equal rights to the followers of all faiths in Iraq. But since a large part of the new legal system is based on Islamic law, or Sharia, the conflict between Sunni and Shia may have legal consequences as well. But what exactly is Sharia? David Mann is at the podium with lecture number 2. This piece first aired in July of 2005.
Sharia, the broad term for all of Islamic law, governs every aspect of Muslim life, from religious ritual to business contracts. Sharia is derived from several sources, including the Quran and the Hadith, or the words of the Prophet Muhammad. The strength of Sharia is embedded in its very name, according to David Powers, professor of Islamic law at Cornell University.
The word Sharia means the path. Etymologically, it relates to the path that an animal would make when you lead it back and forth to the river for water, the well-trodden path.
The path may be well-trodden, but it is also wide, with room for the morally ambiguous aspects of life. Professor Clark Lombardi, an expert in Islamic law at the University of Washington.
The Sharia places actions onto a five-part scale, which are mandatory, recommended, morally neutral, reprehensible, and forbidden. So legally speaking, the only two categories that really matter are mandatory and forbidden, and then there's a whole world of permissible. So when we talk about people following Sharia, they're going to struggle to find out what they should do, even though it's not something that they have to do.
The struggle to find the right path has been one of the foundations of Sharia. The constant evolution of Muslim society means that new problems arise that the Quran and the Hadith do not directly address. Issues are resolved by Islamic jurists, sometimes by consensus, other times by finding the right analogy. Again, David Powers.
When coffee was introduced in the Middle East in the 1500s, the question arose, is this a substance that it is permissible for Muslims to drink or not? Some argued that it's comparable to wine and that it should be forbidden. Others argued the opposite, and eventually those who argued that it was illicit substance won the day. So using analogical reasoning, Muslim jurists would deal with new issues, topics, and substances by looking back to the Quran and Hadith, trying to find something that was similar but not identical to the new substance and making some kind of inference from the one to the other.
Of course, not all inferences are equal. There are 6 different schools within Sharia, 2 Shia schools and 4 Sunni schools. But generally, the differences are minute and rarely cause conflict among the broader Muslim community.
Muslims accept that they haven't been given clear guidance as to what all these rules are. So every Muslim's obligation is to understand as best he or she can what those rules are and to follow them. So the Sharia, to some extent, is God's law, and then people can only follow their interpretation of Sharia, and there are many interpretations.
Sharia has undergone some large changes in recent history.
Islamic law or Sharia today is not what it was prior to the year, let's say, 1798.
In 1798, Napoleon was conquering the Middle East. Along with his army, he brought Western culture with him, and when Napoleon left, European law stayed behind. This complicated the interaction between Sharia and the state.
There's a struggle going on in many Arab countries between the state, which wants to be the source of law and wants to be able to control law, and the religious scholars who in the past were the source of law. That is to say, in traditional Muslim society, law was not created by a state. It was created by expert jurists.
There are an enormous range of countries that have included in their constitutions provisions which require courts not to enforce any law that is inconsistent, broadly speaking, with the principles of Sharia. And then even in countries that we might think of as purely secular, there are certainly rules that grow out of customary practice which are themselves influenced indirectly by Sharia.
2 extreme examples of the interaction between Sharia and the state are Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Saudi Arabia follows Sharia very closely. They even say that Sharia is their constitution. At the other end of the spectrum is Jordan, whose constitution doesn't mention the word Islam. The drafters of Iraq's constitution are still deciding which model their country will follow. The interim constitution in Iraq included a clause protecting citizens' rights, so long as they do not contradict the rules of Islam. Given the complexities of Sharia, this statement is confusing at best. Professor Clark Lombardi.
One thing it might mean, that courts might interpret it to mean, if it were to be carried over into the permanent constitution, is that only those rules which have been accepted by all schools of Islam over the course of Islamic history would be binding on Muslims in Iraq, and the state would only be obliged to enforce those rules. But frankly, it's sufficiently vaguely worded that we're really going to have to wait to see how the courts interpret it or whatever analogous provision is included in that constitution.
The Iraqi Constitutional Committee is haggling over the language, but Professor Powers doesn't seem worried about any feuds resulting from the argument.
That in Iraq, they would let the Sunnis act in accordance with Sunni law in matters of personal status, marriage, divorce, and inheritance, and let the Shiis act in accordance with Shi'i law. That would be the obvious thing to do.
Lombardi isn't worried either. He believes the flexibility in Sharia makes the argument largely symbolic.
God himself did not necessarily want states to enforce every one of his laws, even the commanded law. And God is thought to understand that for reasons of public policy, states may enforce rules that don't correspond exactly to his command. In other words, the state might, for reasons of public policy, forbid something that isn't forbidden.
So, discussing the future of Sharia in Iraq is really just a guessing game. Its current complexity and ability to evolve make it hard to see just how it will interact with the new Iraqi state. Furthermore, as with law in the United States, everything rests on interpretation. Clark Lombardi told me, as with baseball, so it is with constitutional courts. It ain't nothing until the court calls it. I'm David Mann for War News Radio.
This piece first aired in July of 2005. You're listening to War News Radio, the history lesson. While many compare the war in Iraq to conflicts in Vietnam, a better comparison is found earlier in the century. After World War I, as Europe divided the spoils of the defeated Ottoman Empire, the British administered Iraq. Alan Smith presents our next history lesson.
Look back, and you'll find an earlier story of oil, air power, and occupation. After World War I, the conquering nations of Britain and France divided up the Ottoman Empire. France created Syria and Lebanon. England drew lines around Jordan, Palestine, and Iraq. This new nation would be useful for a British navy that was just switching over from coal. Iraq was rich with oil. However, the British found that their new nation wasn't thrilled at being occupied. After only a few years, the country broke out in a revolt.
The revolt was widespread, very hard to control.
Dr. John Turner, a professor of Middle East history at Kennesaw State University.
The British had gone in, they didn't have enough troops on the ground, this is actually sounds very familiar, and decided that they were going to rule directly. They brought in officials from India, they brought in Indian coinage, and they said, okay, this is the new government. And the local tribal leaders, particularly in the south with the Shia, they rose up in very, very large numbers. And the revolt itself, it took the British a while to get under control, and the only reason the British were able to get it under control is they used aircraft. They had superior technology. They would bomb the groups from the air. They didn't have enough troops on the ground to actually fight a stand-up fight.
The British couldn't deploy the resources because they didn't have the political support. The war was unpopular at home.
Once they had to start committing troops to Iraq in 1920 and increase the numbers, the British public at home said, enough, this is expensive, we can't afford this, we need to draw down our military. The way they choose to keep their influence is to set up Faisal and his Sunni elite as a ruling group, and they set up the monarchy.
King Faisal was placed on the throne in 1921 as a compromise candidate between the revolutionaries and the British. But who was this man brought in to unify a newly drawn nation?
Faisal was one of the leaders of the Arab revolt. He seems to have been a pretty charismatic figure, a very good political leader, able to balance a myriad of interests. The British pick Faisal up and say, we have this problem in Iraq. We've got violence in Iraq. They'd already created Jordan for Faisal's brother, Abdullah, so they give Faisal Iraq, and they put him on a throne in Baghdad.
Faisal was powerful, but hardly independent or democratic, although the monarchy had the look of a democracy. Historian John Turner.
They also set up a parliament, which is more or less it becomes a rubber stamp for the king. It's sometimes fractious, there's sometimes actual debate in the parliament, but more or less this is a tool for the British to divide and rule. And it is a way for the British to maintain their influence. This is why you've heard lots of people rejecting democracy. Then it's not that they're actually rejecting democracy, they're rejecting the form of democracy that they have experience with, that was the British using it as a tool to dominate.
King Faisal was able to walk the thin line between his own country's interests and England's. He kept the simmering resentment for the British policies below a boil. But Faisal died after ruling for 13 years. The kings that followed were not quite as skillful.
You want to reach the point where your state is able to withstand change of rulership and continue without you. They never got to that point. They actually still haven't gotten to that point in Iraq, that it's still subject to who's actually ruling. So when Faisal dies, a lot of the hope for institutional continuity goes with him.
Faisal was in power till 1932. During his reign, the British needed only a token presence on the streets of Iraq to enforce their indirect rule. Not an option now, says Turner.
If America pulls our troops out right now, what will happen will be a nasty, bloody Civil War scramble.
Dr. John Turner, a professor of Middle East history at Kennesaw State University.
For War News Radio, I'm Alan Smith.
This piece first aired in June 2005.
In the 1940s, while the British were trying to teach the Iraqis the best cricket techniques, Arabs across the region were organizing politically to get rid of foreign influence. One of their solutions was Baathism. Anne has more about that movement for Arab unity and identity.
Baathism came to power in Iraq in the late 1960s, when General Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr overthrew the prime minister in the name of Baathism. His second in command? None other than Saddam Hussein, who took power by force less than 10 years later, in 1979. But Baathism did not begin with Saddam Hussein. To understand the origins of the movement, we have to look back before the creation of today's Middle Eastern countries. Into the 20th century, the Ottoman Empire controlled the whole Middle East. Fighting against the Ottomans in World War I, the British actively supported nationalist movements that could help them fight against Ottoman rule. But after the war, as new countries emerged, fractures appeared in these movements. In Syria, occupied by the French, one of these splits produced the Ba'ath Party. Professor Peter Sluglett of the University of Utah.
Essentially, this is a sort of movement which splits off from the old nationalist movement, which essentially, in Syria, came to some sort of quiet collaboration with the French in 1936.
In its early days, Ba'athism was like many other nationalist groups in the region. It called for Arab unity, freedom from foreign influence, and a socialist economic system. Farha Hanam, professor of sociology and anthropology at Swarthmore College, remembers when Ba'athism emerged in her native Jordan.
We want to be socialist, but on our own terms, and that Arabism should prevail over ideas of socialism.
While other Arab nationalist movements stressed the importance of Islam in Arab society, Ba'athism was staunchly secular. According to Wamid Nadmi, professor of political science at Baghdad University, Hussein's rule did in fact follow the Ba'ath ideals, at least in the beginning.
It was a secular party. It took the side of the poor people in the country. They encouraged the public sector, and also they nationalized the oil industry. I think the trouble with the era of Saddam Hussein started when he started his war with Iran.
And pretty soon, Ba'athism acquired its current violent associations.
One of the things that I remember were these Jordanian students who were studying in Iraq and who were shot, who were killed, and the justification was given to us in the media was they rejected to be recruited by the Ba'ath Party. So in my mind, actually, Ba'athism was really linked with these dark sort of ideas about being very brutal, being very oppressive. They never really acquired a sense of credibility, in particular because they really ended up making more like this system where it's only about one individual.
So, while the ideals on which Ba'athism was founded are still alive in the present-day Middle East, most Ba'athist regimes in the region turn to dictatorship. Hanam says that citizens who once embraced Ba'athism's core principle of Arab identity have now turned to Islamism in hopes of finding a new unity.
That's our special historical edition of War News Radio.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Our behind-the-scenes crew includes Emily Hager, Armando Leon, Hansi Lo Wang, and Marty Goldenson. I'm Ann Kolker.
And I'm Ren Elhai. Thanks for listening.